This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 23 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in snowy Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, you sure are. Well, David, after the last episode, we received a bunch of emails and also some comments on the website about our guest and flying commercial missions.
Yeah, actually we did. And I think people will be satisfied with some of the answers as we go through the show.
All right, very good. And what are the topics for this episode?
Well, the first one is commercial use of drones. The second is what the FAA plans to deliver by 2015, with the possibility of it slipping eventually. Sites other than the selected six, sites other than the selected six developing UAS technology. And last, DOS, or a drone operating system.
Oh, very good.
So shall we get started?
All right, let's get started.
Well, Max, we did get a lot of feedback about our last show, and we were very appreciative of it. And I guess one of the comments was how Manny was able to do what he did. And one of the things we found in the last week is the federal ban on drones doesn't stop photography.
That's right. And there are at least several other people who are, well,
Doing what he's doing
or something similar to it in some different ways. We see an article in Arizona Central, federal ban on drones doesn't stop photography. Now, as we've mentioned many times, the FAA bans the commercial use of unmanned aircraft with only some specific exceptions. However, some people seem to be pulling it off. And how are they doing it? Well, this article talks about the website of a Phoenix real estate photography company. They're called Aerial Raiders. And what they do is they fly for free. And they do some aerial video and I think some still photos as well of residential and commercial properties. And as I said, they fly for free. However, and this is maybe sort of the interesting part, they do charge for editing of the video and for consulting as well.
So, yes, they're not using the UAV for a commercial purpose, but they are charged. It's kind of, I don't know, it's following the letter of the law, but not necessarily maybe the spirit of the law. The FAA's Pacific Division office says that an operator of a radio-controlled aircraft can mount a camera on it and shoot video for his or her own personal use. Quote, but if the same person flies the same aircraft, then tries to sell the video or uses it to promote a business, accepts payments from someone else to shoot the video, that would be prohibited by commercial operation. So it's, I don't know. This is just, it's one of those things where we're sort of...
It's fairly gray, I think.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And the FAA isn't really constituted as an enforcement agency, at least not for this. I mean, there are obviously a lot of people flying quadcopters and other unmanned vehicles like this. And the FAA can't possibly be on top of what everybody else is doing. And it's kind of hard to say how many folks are crossing the line and how many are not. This is another really good example of why there's some pressure to arrive at the regulations that apply to these kind of craft so that people know what they can do, what they can't do. Because, you know, David, when there's the prospect of commercial enterprise, people are going to find creative ways to accomplish what they want to accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, the almighty dollar will make people do all sorts of things. Yeah, it's unfortunate. And in the big picture, the FAA doesn't have the time, nor the assets or the results, or nor do I want my taxpayer money going chasing after one person flying a quadcopter taking a picture of some new real estate. Things are going to skate under the radar. But again, I think we should let this be a lesson that, you know, sooner or later it will catch up to people, and we want to do it the right way. And yeah, this is a perfectly good example of not doing it the wrong way, but not doing it the ethical way. I guess we'll leave it at that.
And maybe just one final comment on this. We did reach out to Manny to ask him for some more details about how he's using drones commercially, and we haven't heard back from Manny yet. I wouldn't take that to mean anything particular, because he's a very busy guy, does a lot of traveling, I think. But when we have some more information, some more details from him on his operations, then we'll certainly pass that along.
So let's move on to FAA demonstrations, not an integration of unmanned aircraft in U.S. skies in 2015. This is from nationaldefensemagazine.org. And the Congress mandated that the FAA fully integrate unmanned aerial vehicles into the national airspace by 2015. Now, Congress can't get anything done, but they're insisting the FAA get it all done in 2015. Sorry about that political statement, folks. But Michael Herta, who is the FAA chief, says, I believe we will be able to demonstrate safe integration and what is required for any integration of unmanned aircraft. But out of necessity, I believe it's going to be staged. Basically, he's toting the FAA party line, huh, Max?
Yeah, and he was asked directly by the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee. They asked him, is the FAA going to meet that congressional mandate by 2015? And what David just said is his response, which is not a yes. It's not exactly a no. It's kind of something in between. Huerta also explained that, you know, this is a complex issue, and that the FAA has to consider a number of things. They have to consider the safety of the aircraft, the certification of operators, and how UAS interact with other aircraft. And we know all that, but he's trying to explain to Congress that that's complicated. And under the roadmap and strategy that the FAA is executing, that's just going to take some time. So really what he said was that by 2015, will it be integrated into the airspace? Will we see full integration? He's saying more likely what we're going to see is a demonstration of safe integration, which doesn't mean that it's a done deal.
They want to do it right. It's just now that we've got the six test sites up and things are starting to ramp up, maybe 2015 is not an unreasonable goal, but I'm glad to say he's setting expectations as to say that, you know what, it's probably not going to happen, and it's realistic. And
right.
Maybe for once, we should be satisfied with the fact that they're being realistic and they're giving reasonable timetables, and say, instead of getting the usual that our industry, aircraft industry, has, is we're going to fly on X date and then it's 3 years later before the first flight. So let's say he's setting expectations and maybe the FAA might be able to exceed it. Not that we're going to expect that, but it's a good hope.
It sure is. And speaking of those test sites, as we all know, as you mentioned, the FAA has picked the six UAS test sites, and we've seen some news relating to that. Texas A&M University at Corpus Christi, one of the sites, has already begun testing. They're jumping right in. They're using the American Aerospace RS-16 UAV over ranchland. And they're doing some testing with that. The RS-16 is interesting. It's a fixed-wing, long-endurance aircraft designed primarily for civilian mapping applications.
Yeah, it's just under 12 feet, a 25-pound payload, which is fairly reasonable for cameras, and a 15,000-foot ceiling. So we'll have links to the show notes for about the RS-16, but mapping over ranch land, that's different. But we do say that agriculture and animal culture is one of the prime examples of where the UAVs are going to go. It's just interesting that you're going to map ranch land that you'd have to, you're the owner of the ranch wouldn't know where his lands were. So,
or maybe the animals roaming the ranch land. Maybe that's what you look for. But I guess the idea here is that it's a space that they can use for testing, in this case, mapping applications. That's away from population and allows the testing to occur with kind of a reasonable expectation of safety of the inhabitants, I suppose. But you know, another thing that we're seeing, David, in the news recently is from others besides those six test sites who either haven't given up when they weren't selected or otherwise want to participate in this activity.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was so much competition for these six sites. It's more interesting watching California, and in this case, Arizona, the Sierra Vista Economic Development Foundation, or SVEDF, is set up a 160-acre site in spite of the fact that they were not qualified for the FAA. Them, Ohio, California, they all seem to be moving forward to do their own testing. So they may not be contributing to the FAA, but they're trying to make the best of a situation, and they are moving forward with providing their own testing for the commercial market.
Yeah, they're acting as if they were one of the selected sites in many respects. So in that Arizona facility, they already have a company based in Tucson, Cyclone ADG, and that company is planning to test its UAS ISR product, its intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance product for safety applications to use assisting firefighters, police, the military, and so forth. And, you know, I don't know what the FAA is going to have to say about that, if anything. I mean, if will these be seen as renegade test sites outside of the six that the FAA has designated, and how will they react to that? Now, one of the sites that did not was not selected, that was kind of a surprise, of course, was the Ohio facility. We see in stripes.com that Ohio and Indiana push for place in drone industry, and they're going to act independently of the FAA designation as a test site.
Yeah, Dwayne Embry, the executive director of the Indiana Office of Defense Development, says, quote, "Companies and others will need places where they can test a little, design a little, then test some more. We can essentially do everything we were going to do. It's just without the FAA designation." So these, I don't want to say losers, but non-winners have taken upon the attitude of that we don't need the stamp of approval from the FAA. We're going to move forward and provide the services we had set out to do, which dovetails off of our conversation about New Air, where the comment was the FAA is going to be a client of their own selected test sites.
Right, yes.
So it does kind of beg that, okay, the FAA is going to work specifically with these six sites at their guidelines to achieve their goals, but there really is nothing to say that these other test sites that weren't winners can't support the burgeoning industry. It seems to me there's probably enough UAA testing to go around for everybody to have a hand in it, huh, Max?
Oh, I would think so for sure, definitely. And in some respects, you know, the more people who are trying ideas and coming up with creative solutions, the better for all of us. I guess the question I have, and I don't think there's an answer right now, but the question is, again, how is the FAA going to view this? Does the FAA have to examine all of these other sites and give them their blessing to conduct UAS test flights and development and operations and all that? If that's the case, that puts the FAA in kind of a difficult spot, particularly if a large number of others say, hey, I want to be a test site, and someone else says, hey, I'm going to be a test site, and the FAA has to come and authorize it, approve that. I think it's kind of a confusing situation right now. I'm not sure where it's going to go.
Well, the worst case scenario would be like it's a loser in a recent Pentagon contract. The follow-up is a lawsuit saying that the results were needed to be disputed, and we'd go back to choosing six more test sites again. So I'm hoping that scenario doesn't follow through, and maybe there's a fit for everybody. And New Air, using the example, and the reason why I'm doing that is because we actually have documentation from them and we've spoken to them. Their comment was they had already been testing small UAVs. So the FAA guidelines basically gave them the ability to test larger UAVs. So maybe these other sites will continue to test small SUVs and the FAA will not have any issue with that. It'll be the large full-scale ones that will be they will be the challenges, and the six sites will be able to test the large ones.
Now, speaking of large ones, and as well as kind of continuing a conversation about others who are going to be or intend to do some development and research, we see the U.S. Army is involved, this time with ground-based UAV radar at a number of sites.
Yeah, they're going to install ground-based sense and avoid network, or the GBSAA, at five of their bases: Fort Hood in Texas, Fort Riley in Kansas, Fort Stewart in Georgia, Fort Campbell in Kentucky, and Fort Drum in New York. The reason why they're doing this is because the Army is currently implementing the MQ-1C Gray Eagle. The Gray Eagle is a uprated heavy-duty version of the Predator drone, the MQ-1A. And the Army wants to be able to control these zones that they have set up. Interesting enough, Fort Drum would be pretty close to the New Air, the New York test site, so they might get involved there. But they figure that if they set up these visual ground observers so they don't have to, as the FAA says, have a observer who isn't flying the aircraft, these sense and avoid radars will be able to monitor them to fly the MQ-1 as they work up training. They will also be able to provide the FAA a way for these areas to be avoided by other aircraft.
So the Army has been doing testing in kind of compliance with the FAA regulations. And I guess, David, is the idea here that they're installing these radars, these ground-based radars, to accomplish the same thing, but without all the requirement for an observer or a chase plane or something like that? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think they want to, for the Army's sake, it's not just testing the UAV. It's basically training operationally so that they need to fly them and they need a secure space to fly the operational aircraft in. So it's a way of the Army controlling the airspace so they can freely operate their newest UAV and learn to operate it in an operational kind of environment. It's securing or locking down the airspace in which the training will do, because, you know, we've had Reapers and Predators in the Air Force go down in training accidents, and they're operating in and around airspace that's open to and not regulated. In this case, the Army will have regulated airspace to operate the aircraft in and take them out of the FAA prevalence. The FAA will have the ability to accept the airspace, you know, because they'll be monitored and there'll be a way to, like a military operating area, an MOA.
And I've got to believe, David, that these five installations, these five sites, will be used strictly for the Army. These other civilian operations won't be part of this.
No, I don't think so. These are strictly, this is a way for the Army to create operating areas for their UAVs that is not going to interfere with the general civilian airspace.
Okay. All right. We saw an interesting article on CNBC, Windows for Drones, One Startup is Dreaming Big. I thought this was a really interesting story.
I did too. Well, as I said earlier, the Pentagon is reintegrating into DOS, the drone operating system. They'd like to have one operating system that they can cross-platform so that it's standardizing working. Each drone will have a basic operating system that can be used across the board. A Raspberry Pi for drones, my computer friend expert.
Wouldn't that be great? And we've seen that there's an LA-based company called Dreamhammer, and they've actually created an operating system that sort of fits this description. It's called Ballista, and they've been working on this for, according to this article, for 4 years. So this is not something that is just an idea or a concept. This is actually apparently something that's got some substance. It's not vaporware, I guess, is the way to say it. And some of the big guys have been actually looking at this, haven't they?
Big guys being General Atomics, they're the big ones. So they're looking to use encrypted software under Ballista and they have been testing it in the lab. So it's an interesting concept. One operating system for all drones, and you know, one wonders how often they're going to have to do system updates for this stuff and how different platforms will use the same operating system. You know, from a military aspect, a Predator is different from a Reaper, different to a Gray Eagle. They're used for different purposes, etc. So you have one basic operating system, and then I guess the next thing will be the apps for that specific drone that downloaded from iTunes. So we jest a little bit, but standardization is always important in any industry.
Sure. As I was reading through the article, as I started to go through it, the first thing that I thought of was security. And I mean, we've seen this over and over again where, a system has been developed seemingly without provision for built-in security measures, encryption or whatever. And then these things end up getting hacked. And, you know, as I say, as I was reading the article, I'm thinking that this needs to be bulletproof. This needs to be seriously, secure and have that security built into the operating system. But then when you get deeper into the article, you see that, as you mentioned, David, General Atomics and some others that are looking at this, they're liking what they see so far. But General Atomics is going to continue to use their own encrypted control software underneath Ballista, which suggests that maybe this operating system doesn't have the sort of encryption strength that ultimately needs to be. And that's, to me, that's kind of, well, I guess there are issues associated with that, but that seems to be a kind of a key aspect to an operating system like this, that you don't have to rely on each application, each UAS, providing its own, underlying security and encryption and that kind of thing. So it's interesting. I'm curious to see how this develops.
Well, speaking of security and encryption, we actually got some feedback. One of them was from Eric in Oregon, who sent us a video of a drone that monitors student exams as Campus Sky Spies video. He sent us a video of a DJI Phantom, which seems to be rapidly becoming the ubiquitous UAV with a GoPro camera. But interestingly enough, it was hovering in a classroom over students taking exams.
I think that's incredible.
And anyone who's listened to Airplane Geeks knows that my wife is a college professor. She was absolutely ecstatic with this.
Oh, she liked this idea, huh?
Oh, she actually thought this was a great thing because she just, she wasn't really concerned, unlike Eric, who was concerned about the quadcopter actually losing control and taking out one of the students as they landed on his head.
Well, yeah. I think it's a dangerous kind of an environment to operate the Phantom indoors hovering over a classroom full of people. That doesn't make me very happy.
Well, but, you know, I mean, it definitely would be incentive to study hard and take your exam, because what happened, the threat of having one land on your head because you're cheating is a unique threat. But yeah, it's a little hokey, but it's entertaining. The other thing was, he also sent us a video, and we want to encourage people of doing this, of his first quadcopter on Vimeo, and we'll put that on the notes. Definitely, folks, feedback at theuavdigest.com. Send us your videos. Max and I love watching them and like them, and we want to share them. We want to make this a community, and we like it when we get to see people doing things that Max isn't capable of doing because he can't get it off the ground yet. But definitely, we want to encourage that behavior.
Yeah, and Eric also has a DJI Phantom with the GoPro. So same as hovering over the classroom in that article. And yeah, it's kind of spectacular to fly this thing around over your property and to, you know, show us what the house looks like. It's it's great.
And the other feedback we got was, we got a feedback from our favorite author about flying boats, Jamie Dotson, who was in our episode number 2. And he set up a follow-up, and I put it on our Facebook page, which is Facebook.com/UAV Digest, about J-Lens. They've actually deployed the J-Lens dirigibles over Washington, D.C., and they're starting to be up and running. So that's a little, considering, wow, it was 21 episodes ago. But yeah, J-Lens is now up and running. What do you think about that, Max?
Yeah, it's great. Next time I'm down in that area, I'll have to watch for these things floating up in the sky, watching everybody else, I guess.
Well, I think that should be it, Max. So I have to admit, it was fun just being you and I again, although we're going to have more guests in the future. I kind of like just chatting up every so often, don't you?
Yeah, we'll do it both ways. Some episodes will have a guest, and sometimes it'll feature solely on that guest and what's going on, and other times the guest will participate with us in the conversation, and then other times it'll be just Dave and I, like this one. So you've been listening to episode 23 of the UAV Digest. You can find the show notes at theuavdigest.com. If you want to go straight to this episode, you can visit theuavdigest.com/23. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at UAV Digest. As David mentioned, Facebook, UAV Digest. And our email address. David, what's our email address?
Feedback@theuavdigest.com.
All right. Very good. I think that'll do it. So this is Max in Hartford.
And David in Philly.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening.